From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Muslim world has experienced much violence for decades now, with internecine warfare fueled by foreign interference. In countries like Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and more, conflicts between Sunni and Shia groups in particular draw media attention and spur foreign analysts to make the case that sectarian wars are the primary cause of violence. It is a comfortable trope that builds on a history of Orientalism that the, quote, uncivilized masses of Muslims simply cannot get along with one another because of an ancient division among the followers of the Prophet Muhammad, dividing people and communities today. At present, this conflict appears to manifest in various ways. The Sunni-Shia battles in Iraq and Syria, and the Sunni-dominated Saudi Arabia in a proxy war against Shia-dominated Iran, etc. But it is crucial to understand the true nature of the battles being fought, especially given the United States' long-standing role in arming and backing one side against another. My guest is Nader Hashemi. He is the Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver, author of Islam, Secularism and Liberal Democracy Toward a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. And he's the editor with Danny Postel of the new book, Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. He joins me to discuss that book. Welcome to the program, Nader.
Thanks for the invitation.
So groups like the Council on Foreign Relations here in the U.S. Very much use this idea of Sunni-Shia conflict to explain so many of the battles that are fought in countries like Iraq. Can you give us a sense, for those who are not familiar with the CFR's position, what their justification sounds like, how they make that case?
Well, they make the case in a number of ways. In many ways, it's not unique to them. It actually is reflecting broader views in American political culture with respect to the Middle East. And so one common argument is one that you've alluded to, that Sunni and Shia Muslims have been fighting since time immemorial. This has always been an enduring conflict that really has no solution. There's nothing that anyone can do about it. This is just an enduring feature of Middle Eastern and Muslim societies. That's one argument. A related argument is that sectarian conflict is very much related to the alleged inability of the Islamic world to come to terms with modernity. And this is something that is allegedly, again, rooted in certain aspects of Islamic political thought and Islam's civilizational ethos, sort of the implication being that if you introduce Muslim political values into the public sphere, you get nothing but sectarian conflict. And then the sort of related argument that you hear, that because of the alleged enduring aspect of sectarian conflict, we should support authoritarian dictators because they can keep a lid on this ugly situation. If we don't support them, then we get more sectarian conflict. And they point to, you know, the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the removal of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And they say, see, look, when those dictators were in power, at least things were a lot better for the world and the United States in particular. And so, you know, forget democracy, forget human rights. The only U.S. foreign policy position that, according to this view, makes sense is to support authoritarian despots.
So this is an issue that is rooted, or this framing is rooted in historical instance, you know, and we should actually just go through what the distribution of Sunni Shia populations are before we get to the next part of our conversation. So the majority of Muslims in the Muslim world identify as Sunni, something like 80+%, and then the rest as Shia. Can you kind of map out for us where Sunnis and Shias live, and then we'll get to how better to understand these conflicts?
Yeah, that's basically correct. I mean, the generally accepted figure is that about 85% of Muslims around the world are Sunni Muslims. The rest are Shia Muslims, roughly 15%.
And how do you explain to the average American why there is this difference? What differentiates a Sunni Muslim from a Shia Muslim?
Yeah, that's a good question. different sort of interpretations of Islamic history, really the origins of the initial split among Muslims after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632, revolved around the question of succession. Who should lead the Muslim community after the death of the Prophet Muhammad? The majority opinion took one position, and a minority group of Muslims took another position. I can go into the details if you're interested, but that's where the original split begins. And then a sort of separate sectarian theologies develop around that particular event that over time, you know, produce a constituency of Shia Muslims and Sunni Muslims, of which there are differences and divisions within them. But broadly speaking, that's the origin of the dispute. It's not that different if one wants to understand, you know, by a comparative perspective, you know, the similarity between Protestants and Catholics, sort of common origins, common texts, but different interpretations of history and questions of where political authority and religious authority is properly located. So that's the background. In terms of the geographic distribution, most of the countries in the Muslim world, 50 plus, are majority Sunni Muslim. Iran is majority Shia. Iraq is majority Shia, about 60%. Azerbaijan and Bahrain are majority Shia. And then other countries in the Muslim world have sizable Shia populations. Pakistan, Lebanon, Syria, and I mean, they're all minority populations, and other areas in and around the Gulf. Saudi Arabia has roughly a 15% Shia population. So that's the primary distribution of you know, the Sunni-Shia split.
So let's try to go through one of the major ones. One of the major issues, of course, in recent years has been the war in Iraq. The U.S. toppled Saddam Hussein after September 11th. And we have seen, in addition to the violence directly perpetrated by the United States and its troops in Iraq, there has been a tremendous amount of internecine warfare that can be viewed over broadly sectarian lines. And the thinking is that the Shia majority had been sort of oppressed by the Sunni minority, that the ruling Sunni class, once toppled from power, then became victimized by the Shia majority. How should we view the politics within Iraq in a more nuanced way?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, what you just described is partially correct, but I would add the following elements to it. The fundamental, I think, root and framing of the sectarian conflict in Iraq today has to be located in the authoritarian policies of Saddam Hussein, who was one of the most brutal dictators in the Middle East. It's wrong to describe him, as you did, as a sort of a Sunni ruling class. I mean, he really was running a mafia state. He came from a Sunni background, but he didn't justify his rule by pointing to Sunni theology. It was really, if anything, secular Arab Ba'athist nationalism that was the justifying rule. But he did draw upon, you know, those elements of society that he thought were more loyal, and those were people from his own village. There was a lot of Shia Muslims who were part of that ruling apparatus. But that authoritarian legacy really broke and destroyed the social fabric of Iraqi society. It produced a lot of animosity, a lot of distrust. Broadly speaking, the Sunni, the Shia community, which is the majority, were deeply persecuted. When they tried to organize and mobilize, they were severely repressed. We know the story of the Kurds. They were subjected to chemical weapons attack in the late 1980s. And so when the United States invades and topples Saddam Hussein, Iraqi society was already deeply broken, not just because of the oppressive and extreme repression under Saddam Hussein, but also because of the extreme suffering that Iraq was subjected to as a result of UN sanctions that were placed on Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War that further destroyed, you know, civil society and the social fabric of all Iraqis, ironically at that time strengthening, you know, Saddam Hussein's hand. So when the Americans invade in 2003 and the entire state collapses, you get, you know, predictably, you know, a set of collective disorientation that sets in. The Shia feel they're persecuted, they win the elections, they have the demographic numbers, and they start, you know, ruling in a majoritarian fashion. They don't rule, unfortunately, in the way that many of us hoped they would, in a way that was much more inclusive, but they effectively alienate the 20% Sunni Iraqi population, who then start to sympathize with an emerging Al-Qaeda insurgency that emerges in the aftermath of a broken Iraq, and deliberately and explicitly tries to cultivate a sectarian war as a way of pushing out the Americans and as a way of consolidating their own control. And so this is a policy that they pursue, Al-Qaeda does, with somewhat great success, you know, massive attacks on Shia population centers, religious centers, trying to foment a sectarian, you know, civil war. And the United States, you know, took the position that, look, we want to support the strongest party in post-Saddam Iraq, and that's the Iraqi Shia. That's the figure of Nouri al-Maliki, who basically was a majoritarian, you know, dictator, not dictator, but at least authoritarian populist leader. And that alienated, you know, as I said, the Sunni population of Iraq, who then start to sympathize with this Sunni insurgency. And that brings, you know, that brings brings us to the, you know, rise and transformation of Al-Qaeda into ISIS, where you have, you know, an ISIS contingency that emerges out of the remnants of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And you know the rest of the story. So I think that generally is the background. I don't think you can understand sectarian conflict in Iraq today without first referencing the brutalization that Saddam Hussein subjected Iraqi society to, and then also the American intervention just shattered Iraqi society, and they really didn't press, I think, the Iraqi Shia parties to rule more inclusively, further alienating them and leading to the sectarian conflict that we're talking about.
And how have countries like the United States and their interference, their wars, deepened existing divides within Iraq that might not be so deep had the country had a different history?
Yeah, well, the United States sort of approached the, you know, the situation in Iraq post-2003 with very much a neo-colonial mindset, that there are these three groups. They don't get along. We need to sort of divide up the pieces of the pie along these three among these three groups. And there was no attempt to foster, I think, more of an Iraqi cross-sectarian, more integrated political identity, one that guaranteed would be very difficult to do after the ravages and the, you know, the extreme brutality of Saddam Hussein. But I think did have prospects. So when Karl Bremer arrives on the scene, he was effectively, you know, the American viceroy in Iraq after the toppling of Saddam Hussein. He pulls together, you know, representatives from these three groups and tries to divide up the political pie along those lines. So I think that was a major mistake. The other mistake was trying to disband completely the Iraqi army, which was you know, looking back, I think something that furthered the sectarian conflict, because there was no security force there that could provide stability, and it provided for an opening for these extremist groups, primarily Al-Qaeda, to wreak havoc. So that was a major miscalculation by the Americans. And so those I think are critical background developments that lead us to today.
What about Iran? Let's talk about Iran, where we said the majority of Shias, this is the most sort of Shia concentrated country in the Muslim world. And I mentioned we're seeing this sort of proxy war between Sunni-dominated Saudi Arabia, Shia-dominated Iran, or that's at least the way it's in which it's viewed. How have Iran's sectarian politics developed?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. Officially, when the Iranian Revolution happens in 1979, and even up until today, the official position of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that they do not pursue a sectarian policy, that they are they believe in Muslim unity. They have this annual Muslim Unity Conference. The rhetoric of the regime tries to, you know, talk about Sunni Muslim unity. Iran is very opinionated, I would argue selectively, on the question of Palestine, majority, you know, Sunni Muslims there, no Shia involved. But practically and effectively, Iran's policies in the Middle East, in Iraq in particular, are motivated by catering to and supporting Shia political parties and Shia movements and Shia groups. Those are the constituencies that, for ideological, sectarian, cultural reasons, are more inclined to work with Iran as opposed to Sunni political parties. Iran basically is perceived by large parts of the Sunni Muslim world today as a sectarian power, because the policies that it's pursued, particularly in Iraq after 2009, and critically in Syria, where Iran is deeply implicated in the war crimes and the atrocities that have happened in that country over the last 7 years, Iran is perceived as, you know, pursuing a sectarian set of policies, and those policies have been, you know, identified by its rival in the region, Saudi Arabia, and many Sunnis now, I think, rightfully view the Islamic Republic of Iran not as it would like to be viewed, as a pan-Islamic, you know, country supporting oppressed Muslims, but as a sectarian regime pursuing the interests and favoring one sectarian group over the other. And that's effectively what the Islamic Republic has done. Just to cite one example, in order to sustain the war effort in support of Bashar al-Assad, Iran has recruited its own pan-Shia jihadi movement, if you like, recruiting poor Shia Muslims from Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iraq, offering them money, promising them citizenship, scholarship, benefits for their families.
So a Shia alternative to ISIS, or a Shia
basically
counter?
Yeah. Exactly. And the numbers we don't know, but I would suspect the numbers are as large as ISIS, if not greater, and sent them into, you know, Syria to do basically the heavy fighting, effectively using those poor Shia fighters, young kids, as cannon fodder, while the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps sort of, you know, coordinates the war effort for Bashar al-Assad. So this is one of the, you know, elements and aspects in terms of how Iran has pursued its own Shia-centered sectarian policy in the Middle East. Now, I would also add that their role often gets exaggerated. I think they're very guilty in Iraq in terms of supporting sectarianism, very guilty in Syria. In terms of Bahrain and in Yemen, which we often hear that, you know, the conflict in Yemen is another allegedly, you know, Shia-Sunni conflict rooted in Iran's intervention. I think Iran's role in Yemen is greatly exaggerated by its Saudi adversaries. I think there's a broad consensus among experts that that's the case. The problem in Yemen is fundamentally internal to Yemeni society. So, you know, one has to, I think, be a little bit nuanced in terms of trying to assess the role of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its regional presence. I would add also the other critical factor, the obvious one that we haven't discussed, is the heavy support that Iran gives to Hezbollah, which is its major ally in the region and part of its perceived deterrence force against the possible American or Israeli attack on Iran.
How much does the fear of the U.S. being in opposition to, say, Iran, how much does that lead Iran to fight these battles along sectarian lines?
Oh, yeah, very, very much so. I mean, and this is actually dramatically highlighted by Trump's warm embrace of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in particular, and their deeply sectarian Sunni narrative of the problems in the Middle East. So that relationship, which, you know, was always strong under previous American presidents, but has been risen, has rose to new levels under, you know, Donald Trump, then I think produces a reaction in Tehran where they're saying, look, this is a zero-sum game. The Americans now are openly backing Saudi sectarian Sunni politics and policies in the region. We have to double down on our support for sectarian groups in Iraq and in Syria. If we don't, then we will lose our regional backing. So I think, you know, the United States in that sense, particularly under Donald Trump, you know, has really inflamed sectarianism in very nasty and ugly ways. And I would also, you know, just point out the obvious that in the book that I just edited, there's a really good chapter at the end that talks about desectarianization, what happened to desectarianize the Middle East. And the argument that our contributor makes is that it's very easy to start sectarian conflict, but once it starts, it's a thousand times more difficult to bring it to an end. Once you unleash that genie from the bottle, and when blood is spilt, and when these ideas become deeply entrenched in the political psyche and political culture of societies, rolling that back is incredibly difficult. And so I think this American, particularly Trump, embrace of Saudi sectarianism is going to haunt and further destabilize the Middle East in ways that we really can't predict. But it's not a sign for anything positive coming out of that policy decision.
What about Saudi Arabia? We have to talk about Saudi Arabia, especially given its close relationship to the United States. This is a majority Sunni country, or the Sunnis, the Sunni faction has held power in Saudi Arabia. How do you see Saudi Arabia, the country that has also sort of been a promoter of Wahhabism, this interpretation of Islam, fueling sectarianism in the Middle East?
Well, it's absolutely, I think, central and critical. In fact, you know, I would argue that the role that Saudi Arabia has played in terms of not just promoting sectarianism, but promoting a very radical, ultra-conservative, and puritanical interpretation of Islam has been much more destructive for our planet than you know, what Iran has been doing, minus the case of Syria, where Iran is very guilty. But generally speaking, this is a policy that Saudi Arabia has been pursuing, not just the promotion of Wahhabism throughout the world, but really since 1979, Saudi Arabia invests very heavily in supporting a particular sectarian reading of Sunni Islam, where you start to see conflicts in different parts of the Muslim world where you have mixed Muslim Shia communities for the first time, in part because of this dissemination of a particular, you know, deeply anti-Shia sectarian narrative. I mean, and this has, you know, this has sort of, you know, implications in many ways. I could cite many examples. Two of them, you know, come immediately to mind. ISIS, the worldview, the political theology of ISIS, is deeply rooted in an anti-Shia narrative. In fact, they view sort of Shia Muslims as heretics and, you know, justify their killing. In many ways, you know, ISIS was much more antagonistic towards Shia Muslims than they were toward Americans or Westerners. So that's, I think, one sort of element where you see sort of the spread of Wahhabism really taking hold in this radical group and having dire consequences for citizens in the Middle East. The other interesting example that was brought to my attention, I've been to Malaysia on the extreme ends of the Islamic world in Southeast Asia three times over the last roughly 3 years. And it struck me that when I got off the plane in Malaysia and I started to talk to people, there was an incredible amount of anti-Shia animus sort of in the political culture. And I asked my host, what's going on here? I didn't realize that there was a large Shia community in Malaysia. What's going on? And the answer is basically the very close relationship that the Malaysian government has with Saudi Arabia, the huge amounts of money that Saudi Arabia has been spending in Malaysia and Indonesia to promote and propagate Wahhabism has led to this sort of Shia phobia among Malay Muslims, most of them Sunni, who don't really interact with Shias. They just feel that they're, you know, about to take over if they don't sort of react and respond. So you're seeing this type of, you know, a spread of a very dangerous interpretation of Islam, destabilizing not just, you know, Muslim societies around Sunni Shia sectarian narratives, but also with respect to faith, intercommunal harmony that previously existed in Malaysia and in Indonesia, where, you know, the status of Christian minorities and Buddhist minorities were much more stable than they are today. And the reason why they're not stable is because there has been this influx of a very toxic Wahhabi-centered interpretation of Islam with its roots in Saudi Arabia.
Finally, Nader Hashemi, the book that you co-edited with Danny Postel is not called Sectarianism, it's called Sectarianization. Why?
We view the question of sectarian conflict as a process, as a deliberate attempt by political actors to mobilize people around particular sectarian identity markers as a way of pursuing and advancing their political goals, particularly and specifically staying in power and perpetuating their power. So we contrast the term sectarianization, this active process by political actors to pursue and perpetuate their power, with the more common term that you often hear, sectarianism, which often sort of presupposes this enduring trans-historical force that has always been there in Muslim societies, going back 1400 years. The framing of our book and the argument fundamentally of our book is the reason why you're seeing a rise in sectarian conflict today. It's because there has been a deliberate attempt by authoritarian regimes to mobilize their populations around sectarian narratives, to deflect attention away from their corrupt and incompetent rule, and to perpetuate their own political power by exploiting and engaging in what we call sectarian entrepreneurship as a way of pursuing these political goals. So that's why the term sectarianization is an active, deliberate process that has a context and has actors is the one that we prefer over the more common term sectarianism.
Well, Nader, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and helping us shed a more nuanced light on these issues. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Nader Hashemi is an associate professor and director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver, author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy Toward a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. We've been discussing his new book that he has co-edited with Danny Postel. It's called Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East, and it has contributions from a number of authors. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.